Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, November 23rd. And we're going to carry on with respiratory system today. But I do want to say a couple things about the rest of the class. We only have how many sessions left? One, two, three, four. Four lectures left. And as far as the online modules are concerned, you're just going to have to keep coming to class to find out exactly what's on the final. As far as the Blackboard assignments go, I want to try to keep to the schedule that was in the syllabus because some people are counting on those points. So I don't want to jip anybody out of, there's I think five quizzes left. There's either four or five quizzes in Blackboard that are left. All right, so last night was, I activated one quiz, I think that was 13. So that means then you got quizzes 14, 15, 16, and 17, four quizzes left. So there are 10 points each, so that's an additional 40 points that you can earn for the class. So what I've done for the remaining of the quizzes is that they will all be due on December 15th. Which is the day after the final. It's either December 15th or 16th, but it's the day after the final. So you have from now until then to get those quizzes done. All right, so they're not going to be due every Tuesday. So they're going to be, all of them will be due. The deadline then will be the Wednesday after the final. Yeah. That's including the one that I put up last night. Okay. So that puts you in a little bit of jeopardy. I know that's quite a bit of work, but you guys need those points. And the only other thing is, the other jeopardy that you're in is if you let it all pile up until the day after the final. That's not going to work, right? Even though I extended the deadline, you should be preparing to take those quizzes before the day after the final. All right, but as long as you take those quizzes before I calculate your final grades, that's the only thing that I'm concerned about. And I've got 5 days to submit grades after your last final. So just keep in touch. Also, if you've had problems in Blackboard with those quizzes, I'm not sure how I'm going to incorporate that into your overall grade. For instance, if you got a 1 or a 2 on a quiz because Blackboard bonked you out, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to handle that. If I'm going to drop one quiz from everybody or maybe take the average of all your other quizzes and put that average into that one spot. But, you know, I'll just tell you how I feel comfortable handling that, because some people did get bumped out of Blackboard in the middle of a quiz. Okay, so respiratory system. I'm not quite sure where we ended up last time. We were talking about structures, but the structural and functional unit of gas exchange in the lungs, okay, is what? The alveolus, that's right. And you should know the components of an alveolus. I think we were talking about this last time. Okay, you have the alveolar wall that is, what kind of tissue lines a cavity or covers a surface? It's an epithelium, right? And this epithelium right here is a simple squamous epithelium. And a simple squamous epithelium is designed for exchange, right? Because the distance is very short, so diffusion can occur. All right, so what makes the alveolus up is an alveolar type 1 cell, that's the epithelial cell. There's an alveolar type 2 cell that secretes surfactant, which is like a detergent that gets dissolved in the fluid lining the alveolar surface. And then there are macrophages as well. And macrophages are just monocytes. It's a kind of a leukocyte. These can move around your body by diapedesis, so they can move out of a blood vessel, right, and crawl into an alveolus. And when they leave the circulatory system, they become a macrophage, and a macrophage just means a big eater, right? So they wander around looking for particles, like dust particles, bacterial particles, viral particles, and then they will phagocytize them and then lyse them if all goes well, and then bring back some of the membrane components into the body, into the lymphatic system, so that your immune system can recognize those antigens on the surface of those bacteria and develop antibodies and also other immune responses to it. So the job of the macrophage is not just to clean the alveoli up, but also to help develop an immune response to pathogens that you breathe into your lungs. Oh, and here is a white blood cell I see that's out of the cardiovascular system. So this is on its way to becoming a macrophage from being a monocyte. All right, so the alveoli, you have about 300 million of them, and they're like a little grape, right? And consider that if you were to take a grape and peel the skin and lay it flat on the table, right, you could measure what the surface area of that grape is. Like this piece of paper, what's the surface area of this piece of paper right here? 8.5 by 11, right? You multiply those two numbers together and you can get the surface area. And I think we did the same with a door. Did we do a door last time? We didn't do a door last time. I was kind of hoping we did a door. What's the surface area of this doorway right here? So here I have a nice meter ruler. So we're going to measure the surface area of this doorway. So if we go over here, what is the width of this doorway? Yeah, but this is a meter. Okay, so it's what? 1 meter. That's pretty handy. But to calculate the surface area, what else do we need to know? The height. All right, so we'll measure the height. So here is 1 meter right to here. And then here is 2 meters. It's exactly 2 meters. That's really nice. So we can calculate the surface area of this doorway right here. It's what? 1 times 2, or exactly 2 square meters. All right, so what does that doorway, what kind of function does that doorway perform for the room right here? It allows for exchange of people, basically, from inside the room to outside the room. And what I want you to appreciate is, how does exchange go as the size of the doorway changes? If the size of the doorway increases, what can you tell me about exchange? Yeah, so right now you could probably get maybe 2 people through that doorway at one time, but if we made it bigger, right, you could get more people through at that same time. So instead of a pedestrian doorway like that, if you consider a doorway on your garage that your car drives through, but now think how many people can go through that doorway. Right, it's huge. Maybe you can get 20 or 30 people through at one time. So the relationship between exchange and surface area is that if the surface area increases, so does exchange. So if you want to have a lot of exchange, you need a big surface area to support that kind of exchange. So go back to the lungs, all right, and take all those 300 million alveoli, right, and flatten them out so that they're all completely flat, filled in all the spaces. The surface area that you have would be about 80 square meters. So what's that? That's like 40 of those doorways right there. All right, so that's a huge surface area for exchange. And as a matter of fact, what is that equal to in everyday life? That's about half of a tennis court. So the surface area for your lungs is about the surface area of half of a tennis court. And it's kind of fortunate that evolution has figured out a way to take that big surface area, fold it up in the surface of that alveolus, right, to give you that functional surface area. But you don't have to be as wide as a tennis court, which personally I like, right? So that's a nice advantage, or as tall as half of a tennis court. So that's a nice thing. So the other concept that I want you to not forget is that when we say surface area, all right, especially in terms of exchange, I want you to think of that structure over there. What was that we just measured? Not a piece of paper, but a doorway. So when somebody says surface area, you're just automatically going to be thinking, oh, well, it's a doorway for something. All right, so when we get to the digestive system, we'll look at the doorway or the surface area for the digestive system as well, because you're going to be absorbing nutrients in that particular case, and not just exchanging gases. Okay, so that is the alveolus. That's the structural and functional unit of exchange and the lungs. So also don't forget any of those structural and functional units that we talked about in class. Like, what's the structural and functional unit of life?
Cell.
A cell. Structural and functional unit of communication between cells.
Synapse.
Perfect. And the structural and functional unit of contraction?
Sarcomere.
Right? So these are really handy concepts. Okay. All right, so these alveoli form a honeycomb structure. The upper respiratory tract is composed of the nasal cavity and the pharynx. The lower respiratory tract starts at the larynx right here, and we call this the conducting zone. So the shape of these structures does not change during inspiration or expiration because they have cartilage around them. So the larynx, the trachea, and bronchi have cartilage. They're lined with that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, which warms and humidifies the air. And in that epithelium, there are goblet cells that secrete a product onto the surface of those ciliated cells. What does a goblet cell secrete? Mucus, right? That helps trap dust particles so that our lungs don't fill up with debris. And the cilia are sweeping all the time. Which way do you think they're sweeping? Up to your mouth, not down into your lungs, because their job is to clean the lungs out. And then when that bolus of mucus and dust particles gets into your mouth, what happens? And if you're a baseball player, of course you spit, but if you're a normal person, well, you just swallow it down, okay? Okay. Not a softball player, baseball player. Okay. So let's talk about the thoracic cavity. That's bounded inferiorly by the diaphragm, and the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. It's dome-shaped. It's not flat, even though it's a sheet of muscle. All right, the thoracic cavity also contains the heart, blood vessels, and all these other things. Okay, I have no idea why the abdominal pelvic cavity is in there, other than that might assist sometimes in certain kinds of breathing. All right, and don't forget the space that the lungs are in are the pleural space inside the thoracic cavity, and that is a cavity that's not open to the outside world, so it's lined with a serous membrane. And so you should be aware of the three components of a serous membrane. You have the visceral pleural membrane right on the surface of the lungs. Then you have the parietal pleural membrane on the body wall. And then you have serous fluid between those two membranes right there. And the best way to think of that serous fluid is that it is a watery kind of fluid. We're going to look at another kind of fluid that actually lines the inside of an alveolus, and its nature is going to be completely different. So we're going to look at some properties of water. Okay, so how does ventilation result, right? Well, it's due to pressure differences. So air, which is a fluid, is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure, right? So air moves from high to low pressure. The lung has a lot of elasticity, at least a normal lung does. It has some surface tension, right, which can influence ventilation. All right, so surface tension in particular in this pulmonary space right here between the visceral and parietal pleura. There's a lot of surface tension because what did I say that fluid was like in here?
Water.
Was watery. Okay, so it's a water kind of fluid right in there. Okay, so, come on, next slide. Okay, so during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is about -3 millimeters of mercury. So millimeters of mercury is a pressure measurement, and this is below atmospheric pressure. All right, so atmospheric pressure is typically about 760, and so we just consider that for these measurements to be zero. So the pressure inside the lungs during inspiration is -3. And it's zero outside, right? So where is pressure lower, -3 or 0?
-3.
All right, so air is going to flow from the atmosphere into a person's lungs because that's the pressure gradient. During expiration, the pressure changes the other way. Now, the pressure inside the lungs gets to be about 3 millimeters of mercury, and it's zero in the outside world, so air flows out of your lungs. So in this table, table 16.1, what I want you to look at is this intrapulmonary pressure right here. That's the most important one that I want you to look at. So I'm not going to explain intrapleural or transpulmonary pressures, just the intrapulmonary pressure, which is the pressure inside the alveolus. Okay, so during inspiration, air goes in because it's below atmospheric pressure. During expiration, air flows out because it's above atmospheric pressure. All right, so how do these pressure changes occur inside the lungs? And here is an important physical law, and it's Boyle's law. that says that pressure is related to volume. So if you have a closed container, and I did pass the sign-in sheet around, right? It's going around someplace? Yeah, good. Okay. So there is a relationship between pressure and volume, and you need to state this relationship out. Okay, so what is this relationship? It's kind of fancy because we have a little dash right here instead of a dividing sign, but that's really a dividing sign right here. What is the relationship between pressure and volume in a closed system? It's inversely related, right? So that if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases, because that's an inverse relationship. If the volume decreases, the pressure increases, or if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases. All right, so that's a really important law. Make sure you know Boyle's law that shows the inverse relationship between pressure and volume. So basically, that's how pressure changes inside your thoracic cavity, or how the intrapleural or intrapulmonary pressure changes. Okay, so increase in lung volume decreases intrapulmonary pressure. Right, does that make sense? Increase in volume, pressure has to decrease. And that happens during inspiration, air flows in your lungs. Right? A decrease in lung volume raises the intrapulmonary pressure, causing expiration. So just look at this equation right here. Okay, so what's a good way to think of that? Well, we could do this little experiment with this artificial lung right here. And the lungs we have made out of some balloons. Is it too dark to see, or can people kind of see this thing? Hopefully you can see this. So here's just a glass bell, so the size of this bell can't change. And the inferior part of the bell right here has this rubber membrane, which is going to model the diaphragm. Okay? And then there's a hole right here that's going to be like the trachea, and then you can see it bifurcating into the bronchi to feed both right and left lungs. So during rest, when you're not inspiring or expiring, the diaphragm has what kind of shape to it?
Dome.
It's dome-shaped, right? So I got to push up on that little membrane right there. And what happens to the balloons when I push up? Are they inflated or deflated?
Deflated.
They're deflated. So in a resting circumstance, that's how your lungs are. But when you want to inspire, your diaphragm contracts. So the diaphragm is normally like this. When it contracts, the filaments slide over each other, right? And it becomes flat. All right? So the dome, right, moves inferiorly. So let's do that. So if I pull the diaphragm inferiorly, what happens to the balloons? Do they inflate or stay the same?
They inflate
because we've increased the volume of this bell right here. Increasing the volume decreases the pressure, right? That's Boyle's law. And air flows from high pressure in the air into low pressure inside the balloons. All right, now during expiration, the diaphragm goes back up to its dome-shaped position like that. And now since we've decreased the volume of the bell, what happens to the pressure? Decreasing volume means what? Increasing pressure. So now the pressure inside the balloons is higher than atmospheric pressure, so it flows out of the balloons into the air. So this is kind of what you're doing all day long. Ventilating. All right, so the lungs can do that because they are highly compliant, right? It's very easy for them to expand with very small pressure changes. And when these things expand, that means air is flowing into the alveoli, which is what you need for gas exchange. Another important property is elasticity, right? So lungs are very elastic. There are a lot of elastic proteins that surround every alveolus. So what the heck does that mean? If once an alveolus expands, okay, and if you take away the pressure that caused it to expand, all right, what's going to happen to that alveolus? Those elastic fibers are going to cause that alveolus to contract down back to its original shape. All right, so, and that elastic tension increases during inspiration, all right, and during expiration, then that tension is released. So that's, let me see if I can find a good example of alveolus someplace. Oh, I don't know. Oh, right here. All right, so here you have, okay, I see an air passageway right here, and I can't see any cartilage on this passageway, this airway right here. So that tells me something important, that this is not part of the larynx. because it has cartilage. It's not part of the trachea, because trachea has cartilage. And it's not a bronchus, because all bronchi have cartilage as well. So this is a bronchiole. Bronchioles are the first part of the airway that no longer have cartilage, but they do have smooth muscle right here, right, which is controlled primarily by the sympathetic nervous system. Ooh, what kind of receptors are in these smooth muscles right here? Anybody remember? That was part on the, what kind of adrenergic receptors are in these smooth muscles of bronchioles? Beta, beta 2, that's right, beta 2 receptors right there that cause, okay, dilation of these bronchioles, right, which enhances airflow. All right, and here we can see the alveoli. It's surrounded by a capillary network. But what's not drawn on this slide, which you might want to draw in, maybe draw a little alveolus right here, there are other fibers that crisscross back and forth, which are elastic fibers, right? And so those elastic fibers, once an alveolus is inflated, help do what? Deflate the alveolus during expiration. And that's really important, because if you inhale and expand an alveolus, and on expiration, if the air doesn't leave the alveolus, guess what happens to your next inspiration? It can't happen because it's already filled with air, right? And so that's going to reduce gas exchange. So those elastic fibers are extremely important for normal ventilation. All right, so here's where you would draw. In your old anatomy books, there are nice pictures of those elastic fibers right there. Okay, so I've got a couple things right here that can model an alveolus. I got a couple chambers. All right, I've got a paper bag, and I have a balloon right here. And so after I demonstrate an alveolus, you have to tell me, this is just a little pop quiz, you have to tell me which one is a better model of an alveolus. All right, so the diaphragm is going to contract, air is going to flow into an alveolus. So here is an alveolus, so let's get it expanded. Okay, so it's not expanded. All right, so there's inspiration. Okay, and during expiration, things just relax. All right, the diaphragm relaxes, the alveolus relaxes. All right, so I'm making sure that there's a nice hole in the bag right here. And if I let go of the bag, what happens to this alveolus right here? Is it going to collapse, or is it going to stay the same shape? It's going to stay the same shape. All right, so that's one model of an alveolus. Here's another model. Okay, here's a little balloon. See if I can blow it up. Oh, good. It didn't pop. These balloons sometimes are pretty old. Okay, so here I have a balloon, right? And, oops, sorry. And so now we're going to go through an expiration, all right? And what's going to happen to this alveolus? What's it going to do? Because of the elastic properties, it's going to kind of go back to its original shape. So which is a better model of an alveolus, this balloon or this paper bag? The paper bag would be a diseased lung, okay, and the balloon is what? A nice healthy lung. And lung tissue is very delicate tissue like this balloon, right? It's one of the most delicate tissues in your body, and you should really pay close attention to protecting that tissue. Don't stick stuff in your lungs that don't belong there, okay, for all kinds of reasons. So the elasticity of the alveolus is very important because it helps with expiration. And there are people that lose those elastic fibers and they have decreased pulmonary function as a result of that. Okay, they're miserable. Okay, surface tension is an important consideration for the lung as well. Okay, so elastic properties are important to get the alveolus to collapse. But there are some other properties, especially of water, that might prevent the expansion of an alveolus, and that is surface tension. And we've talked a lot about water. And what can water form with another water molecule?
Hydrogen
bonds. That's right. So that when you think of water, you should ask yourself a question, is it sticky or is it a slippery substance? Okay, if you have water like on this linoleum floor over here and you step on it, you're going to slip, right? So that's kind of how you remember water, but because of those hydrogen bonds, you should really realize that water is a sticky substance, All right, because water molecules like to stick together because of the hydrogen bonds that they form. It's not very strong bonds, but nonetheless, they're still there. And as a matter of fact, there are quite a few animals that can actually walk right on the surface of water. All right, like a stream or a pond. Anybody ever see an animal walking on water? Well, maybe even lizards, but spiders and various insects, right? They're not heavy enough to break all of those hydrogen bonds, so they can really walk right on the surface of water. So water really is sticky, and maybe even at home you recognize that. Maybe you had a couple saucers or plates that weren't dry, and you put them together that had a water film between them, and you tried to separate them, and there was really no way to pull them apart. You could only slide them apart, okay? And that's because of surface tension of all those water molecules. So we could do another little experiment right here just to make sure that you see that water is a sticky substance and not a slippery substance. Here I have two acetates, some overhead slides, and if I put them together, they're dry right now, okay? And if I let go of one, go ahead, catch it, it's just going to fall on the floor because they're not glued together, right? So what would we want to do to stick these things together? Put some glue on them, right? And where do we have glue? Right in this faucet right here. So I'm going to come over to this little glue faucet, turn it on, hopefully I won't spray, who's that guy that gets his audience all wet? Gallagher. Okay, so let's put some water on here. All right, we got some water. Now let's glue these together like that. Okay, and so the only thing I have on there is water, and if I just hold one of the acetates up, it's not going to fall down whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, maybe I need some help. Just grab that little margin right there, and now we're kind of pulling. It's sliding. Okay, sometimes I can almost like pull somebody out of their chair. I don't know why that was so easy. Maybe they're a little dirty. But nonetheless, you can see the surface tension gluing these two pieces of paper together, these two acetates together. All right, so that has an important consideration for the lungs. For instance, if you look at an alveolus on this slide right here, right, if there was just water, then one wall of an alveolus, when it touches the other side, when they approximate each other, they're going to get stuck together. And then an alveolus won't be able to inflate no matter what you do to the pulmonary pressure. Right? And furthermore, there's this law of Laplace that says, right, that the pressure in an alveolus is directly proportional to the surface tension and inversely proportional to the radius. What this means is that, right, if there is a small alveolus, right, if there is surface tension in alveoli, that means that there would be high pressure in small alveoli, low pressure in big ones, and so which way would air flow? From small alveoli into large ones. And as a matter of fact, even the largest alveoli, so when you inflated your lungs, all the air would flow into just that one biggest alveolus. But how many do you need for exchange to take place in your body? You need 300 million of them, right, for the proper size doorway. So if only one alveolus inflated instead of all 300 million, right, there's no way that you could survive. So your body has to deal with this surface area, with this surface tension. It has to be defeated somehow. And what defeats surface tension is this alveolar type 2 cell. It secretes a phospholipid, which acts like a detergent. So if we put soap on your hands and then water and you rub your hands together, is that a sticky substance or a slippery substance? Now that's really slippery, right? If we put some soapy water on the floor, you'd really slip on that. All right, so the surface, this surfactant right here decreases surface tension for two reasons. So that an alveolus can inflate when the walls and alveolus touch each other, but also so that all the alveoli in your lungs inflate, so that all the air just doesn't go into one alveolus. And surface tension works by what? By reducing all of those hydrogen bonds between the water molecules. So water really is sticky. All right, so make sure you know something about that surfactant. What problems that causes? Well, what are some of the problems that it causes? All right. Surfactant secretion begins really late in fetal life. This is before you're born. And those type 2 cells really don't become activated until there is stress on the baby as it's being born. So that's what causes those type 2 cells to start secreting surfactants. So if it is not a late-term delivery, right, if it's an early-term delivery, then that baby won't be secreting the right amount of surfactant. What does that mean? That means that their lungs won't inflate and they won't have proper gas exchange. And what do we have to do for somebody in that circumstance that doesn't have the proper doorway? We have to put them in an atmosphere that is high in oxygen, right? So even though they don't have the proper doorway, at least the concentration gradient of oxygen helps favor absorbing oxygen in their body. All right, so we call that respiratory distress syndrome. And of course, that happens most with cesarean sections on very early term infants, because it's the process of being born that stimulates those cells into secreting surfactant. All right, that might happen in some adults if they're in septic shock. We would call that acute respiratory distress syndrome that decreases the stretchability or compliance of the lungs because surfactant is not being secreted. They're going to have decreased pulmonary function as well. All right, so that's from the type 2 cells. All right, as far as ventilation is concerned, right, we got inspiration and expiration that's ruled by Boyle's law, by pressure, by volume changes inside the thorax. So here we have a couple of plain films of a lung at the end of expiration and then a plain film at the end of inspiration, and you can see the changes in volume of this lung. All right, and what is that doing? When the thorax changes volume like this, it's then changing. What's Boyle's law say? Yeah, it's going to change the pressure, and it's inversely related. So as the volume increases from condition A to condition B right here, what happens to pressure over here? Since the relationship is inverse, pressure decreases, so air flows in, right? And as the diaphragm relaxes, goes back up. Now, don't forget, there's elastic in the diaphragm as well, right? So that's why it goes back up to that dome shape. There's elastic fibers around every alveolus that aids in expiration. All right, so there are actually two ways that people breathe. There's quiet breathing and forced breathing. Quiet breathing is what you're doing right now, and forced breathing is what you do when you're exercising, so when you're hyperventilating. So there are different mechanisms under play, depending on what kind of expiration that you're participating in. All right, and I do want you to know some muscles of inspiration and muscles of expiration. All right, so inspiration during quiet breathing occurs mainly because the diaphragm contracts, right, increasing the thoracic volume. There are some parasternal and external intercostals, like these external intercostals right here, contract. They raise the ribs laterally, so the rib cage moves up laterally, the sternum moves up and out anteriorly, that increases the volume of the thoracic cavity as well, decreasing the pressure, right, and that helps with inspiration. So the most important muscle, though, is the diaphragm, but you might be using the external intercostals just a little bit. Now, for expiration, all right, it's a completely passive process. You don't need any muscles for expiration if you have a normal lung, because the elastic properties in the diaphragm cause it to go back up, right, and the elastic properties around the alveolus cause the alveoli to shrink. So quiet breathing, expiration, is completely passive in the normal lung. Deep breathing, on the other hand, for instance, when you are exercising, involves a whole different set of muscles. All right, so inspiration involves contraction of the scalenes, which you probably had to learn, which go to the first and second rib. It elevates the first and second rib, and then the external intercostals are attached to the first and second rib, right, by these various connections right here. So that helps elevate the rib cage, and the pectoralis minor as well helps elevate the rib cage, and the sternocleidomastoid helps promotes elevation of the rib cage. So for hyperventilating, you have scalene, sternocleidomastoids, and pectoralis major. All right. And expiration now is completely different. For quiet breathing, it's completely passive, but for hyperventilating, then you'd need abdominal muscles. So like the rectus abdominis and the transverse and internal, external, oblique, contract, compressing contents in the abdominal cavity, right? So they get squished and they move superiorly and help, right, press on the diaphragm to help move it more superiorly. All right, so abdominal muscles for helping expel air, as well as internal intercostals, will pull the rib cage down. So that's just a little tricky. All right, so internal intercostals are important for expiration, and the external intercostals are important for inspiration. All right, so that's just a little bit of memorization. Okay, so I think we talked about pressure changes already in the lung. One thing that I will mention maybe on this slide right here, okay, is this space right here, this pulmonary space. All right, what did we say about the lining of alveoli? Okay, it has the lining of alveoli. What prevents the alveoli from sticking together, the wall, opposite sides of the wall of an alveolus? Surfactant. Okay. Now, this pulmonary space right here does not contain surfactant. What did I say? What kind of fluid was in this serous fluid? It was watery. All right. So, what is a watery fluid? Is it slippery or sticky? It's sticky. All right. So, this serous fluid right here helps attach the surface of the lungs to the thoracic wall. So, when there are changes, right, when the thoracic wall expands, that actually helps pull on the lung tissue because it's glued via the surface tension. So that also helps in inflation of the lungs. Okay. So we like to look at lung volumes in people under various kinds of conditions. And we use an instrument called a spirometer. Maybe you use a spirometer in lab. So that study of lung volumes using a spirometer is called spirometry. And it can measure air moving in and out of the lungs, and it can measure various kinds of spaces, right? And so let's take a look at this graph right here. So we have a graph of volume versus, this is like time right here that somebody is breathing. And it goes from about 0 liters up to 6 liters. And when you're breathing normally, right, quiet breathing, you breathe in and out right here. And this is about 500 mLs. This is what we call tidal volume. So this is what you need for your normal metabolism when you're at rest. But when you start to exercise, you could need 100 times more oxygen to make ATP that you're using up. So there are some reserve volumes in the normal lung. The reserve volume, if you take a normal inspiration and that stop, and then inhale as forcefully as you can, this volume right here, above tidal volume, is just called the inspiratory reserve. Right? Furthermore, at the end of an expiration, there's still plenty of air left in your lungs, and if you really contract your abdominal muscles and internal intercostals, you can expel more air from your lungs. We call that the expiratory reserve volume. So if we add expiratory reserve, tidal volume, and inspiratory reserve volume together, this is the maximum amount of air that you can move in and out of your lungs when you try really, really hard. All right? And so when we take these basic lung volumes and add them together, we get something called a capacity. And this is what we call the vital capacity. Expiratory reserve, inspiratory reserve, and tidal volume. All right, so don't forget this graph. You'll see this graph pretty much in every physiology class, right, that you might ever take, because it's a very standard kind of diagram. All right, the other thing that I want you to know on this diagram right here is that because there are airways that have cartilage on them that never collapse, there is a residual volume in your lungs that you can never expand. So there's over 1 liter of residual volume inside your lungs in a normal lung that's always trapped inside your lungs unless, a grizzly bear or an elephant or something sits on your chest and completely flattens it out, right? So that residual volume is there. So if we add vital capacity and residual volume together, we get the total lung capacity. Now, when somebody has pulmonary disease, guess what happens to them? Okay, maybe a number of things. Maybe the alveoli degenerate. All right, and then that increases the residual volume. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and as residual volume increases, what happens to your vital capacity? Yeah, it gets less and less and less, right? And indeed, some people's pulmonary pathology gets so bad that residual volume gets so big that they have no inspiratory reserve volume or expiratory reserve volume, and all they have left is this tidal volume right here, and then the tidal volume even starts to get eroded away by residual volume as their pathology increases. All right, so what happens then when somebody's residual volume is so large that they can no longer ventilate their lungs? Well, then you need a lung transplant, okay, when that happens. So be familiar with this little diagram right here. All right, so that's a nice exam figure. So here are some definitions for lung volumes that we just went over. So that's a pretty important table right there. Okay, so gases that we're breathing are actually a mixture of gases. Okay, just like consider it like a solution. And instead of concentration, we think of partial pressures. How much pressure is being produced by a particular molecule in that mixture of gases. All right, so partial pressure is just the pressure that a particular gas in a mixture exerts independently of all other gases that are in there. And that's really nice, simple algebraic expression, and that's called Dalton's Law, which states that the total pressure of gas in a mixture is just the sum of all the partial pressures. All right, so what was that other law that you have to know? Boyle's Law. Well, what's Boyle's Law?
Pressure
and volume, how are they related to each other? Inversely related to each other, right. Okay, and Dalton's Law just says that the total pressure of a mixture of gases is going to be due to the partial pressure of each of the individual gases right here. So in air, we have nitrogen, and we have oxygen, CO2, and also we have water vapor. And if we add all these up, we get atmospheric pressure at about 700 millimeters of mercury. All right, and if it's very dry air, right, atmospheric pressure stays the same, so some of these other components right here are going to change to make up for that water vapor that is lost. All right, so gas exchange in the lungs is driven by differences in partial pressure. So when you look at partial pressure right here, you should think of that as being like, what? A concentration gradient in a solution. So in terms of a concentration gradient, how are things going to diffuse? From high to low, and the same thing for partial pressure gradients. Things are going to diffuse from high pressure to low. So in inspired air, okay, water vapor is going to be highly variable, but inside the alveolus, it's relatively high. It's a very humid environment. So which way is... I guess I don't want to say that right now. Okay. Let's just look at the gradient. From air outside your body to air in the alveolus, all right, we can see that water is going to leave your body. What about CO2? That's going to leave, right? It's 40 millimeters of mercury in alveoli, and oxygen is going to move in, right? And nitrogen, I'm not sure it really moves one way or the other because it's so inert that we really don't consider it. Okay, but if you add up all these different partial pressures, you see that it still adds up to 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay, gas exchange, we talked about this figure already. Okay, there's one item. There's something called the respiratory membrane. Right, and the respiratory membrane, if you look at an alveolus right here, I tell you what, let me go back a couple slides. Maybe you don't watch me flip through all these different slides right here. Okay. All right, here is what we call the respiratory membrane. It is just the structure that material has to diffuse across as it's going from blood to alveolus or from an alveolus into the blood. That's the respiratory membrane. And there are four components to that respiratory membrane. There is the wall of the capillary, which is just what? A simple squamous endothelium. Then there is a very thin basement membrane. There is the wall of the alveolus right here due to the alveolar type 1 cells. And then there is a layer of water with surfactant. So that is the respiratory membrane. The layer of surfactant, wall of the alveolus, then the connective tissue and interstitial space, and the wall of a capillary. Those are the four components that make the respiratory membrane. That's what molecules have to diffuse across, like oxygen and CO2. Okay, which is what? A short distance for diffusion. Okay, so how do we get blood into the lung? That's the pulmonary circulation, right? And the flow through the pulmonary circuit has to equal the blood flow through the systemic circuit. Otherwise, blood is going to get stuck in some part of your circulatory system, right? But it's always going to be continuously flowing around. All right, but because the pulmonary circulation is so short, it has very little resistance. And so that means that there can be less pressure gradient from the pulmonary artery to a pulmonary vein to get the same amount of flow through it. And indeed, the pressure is about 50 millimeters of mercury less. And that's because the pulmonary vascular resistance is so low. And that's basically due, why? Because it's a short circulation. And according to Poiseuille's law, you remember that the length of a blood vessel helps determine what the resistance is. So there's less pressure in capillaries, right? And that's a very beneficial thing, because as the pressure decreases in a capillary, that produces less net filtration in the pulmonary capillary. So less fluid leaves pulmonary capillaries compared to systemic capillaries, because there's less pressure. And this helps prevent pulmonary edema as a result of that. So most of the fluid, okay, entering the lungs through the vasculature stays within blood vessels. Unless somebody has pulmonary hypertension, for instance, then pulmonary edema can become an important issue. All right, so pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2 is low and dilate where it's high. What the heck does this mean? Well, that matches ventilation to perfusion. So I want to compare and contrast this with a systemic vascular bed. What the heck does this mean? Well, let's start by just thinking about the lungs. Why is blood going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, right? To pick up oxygen. And there's no sense going to a part of the lung where there is no oxygen present. Okay, now what's the function of a systemic capillary? Is it going to a systemic capillary to pick up oxygen or to deliver oxygen?
To deliver.
So again, the pulmonary and systemic circulations are kind of opposite each other in terms of function. So if we look at systemic, let's see if I can write on the board right here. All right, systemic circulation. Let's consider local control. So here we have a bunch of muscle fibers, right? These are nice striated muscle fibers, and they're exercising. What happens to this area around this muscle fiber that's contracting? What about oxygen? When this muscle is contracting, what happens to oxygen in this area? Does it go up or go down? It goes down, because these mitochondria in here are using oxygen to make ATP, right, to support that contraction. And then what happens to CO2? It goes up. So here we have, in the systemic circulation, under exercise, right, we have oxygen decreasing and CO2 increasing. And then here we have a capillary, right, here we have a capillary that's delivering oxygen to this muscle. And what's at the entrance to every capillary? There's a sphincter, yeah, that pre-capillary sphincter right here. All right, so when the muscle is exercising, there are high levels of CO2 and probably lactic acid. These molecules go back to this precapillary sphincter and tell it to do something, which is what? Which is to dilate. All right, so these metabolic products of this particular tissue cause dilation of that precapillary sphincter. Now, does that make sense? As this dilates, then what happens to blood flow through this capillary? It goes way up, right, according to the fourth power rule. So what happens? Then that gets rid of CO2, delivers oxygen, right? So decreasing O2, increasing CO2 is the stimulus, but the response is the opposite way. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism, making sure that this muscle can still exercise. So this is what we call local control. Right? It doesn't require any innervation or hormones or anything from other parts of the body. It is just controlled by the local metabolism of this tissue right here. All right, now what about the lung? What did we say about the lung? Pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2 is low. Okay, what about the systemic? When PO2 is low, what happens to this muscle right here? It dilates, but what about in the lung? We say it does what? It constricts. Why is it opposite? Can be kind of confusing. Okay. All right, so here we have an alveolus. Oh, good. It never blew up. So here we have a capillary, pre-capillary sphincter right here, and an alveolus. And in the slide, what does it say? Low O2 inside the alveolus. Okay, now why is blood going to this alveolus right here? To give up oxygen like a systemic capillary or to pick it up? Okay, but if there's no O2 right here, why should the body be pumping blood to this alveolus if there's no O2 in it or if it's low? It doesn't really make any sense. So the local control in the lung causes constriction of this sphincter right here. So instead of blood going to this alveolus, guess where it goes? It goes to another alveolus. Ooh, I need a pen that works. It goes to another alveolus someplace. Yeah, that one works pretty good too. It goes to another alveolus. Okay, let's try it. Yeah, they're erasers instead of markers. Okay, so blood goes to an alveolus. Better grab two of them. All right, that's sort of good. All right, so blood is diverted from an alveolus that is low in O2 to one that is high in oxygen. All right, and if it's high in oxygen, here we have a capillary, and what about that sphincter? It's dilated. All right, so now we have... So there's low oxygen in the blood, high oxygen in here. We get a big concentration gradient. And so then this blood becomes oxygenated basically by alveoli that have oxygen to give up. So that concept of the lung is ventilation perfusion matching, which is the opposite that happens in systemic circulation. So systemic is over here, pulmonary is here. Pulmonary circulation is right here. So that's perfusion is what? Blood moving through capillaries. Ventilation is when we move air in and out of alveoli. So this local control is opposite. The pulmonary local control is opposite to systemic local control, because in the lung we have to match ventilation with perfusion so that oxygen enters the blood. That's very important. So there's no reason why blood should go to alveoli that don't have oxygen in them, which is the opposite circumstance over here. All right, so that maybe produces some interesting effects. I don't think I'm going to go over this slide. There are still some differences in ventilation and perfusion. Still, the apex of the lung has a better ventilation perfusion ratio. Right, as you get deeper down to the base of the lung, the perfusion ratio is not quite so big. So the most important parts of the lung are these more apical regions right here. All right, so what does that mean kind of in everyday life? There's a condition that we're beginning to appreciate and understand as being very important, and it's called sleep apnea. So this kind of relates to the respiratory chapter that we're talking about right now. What the heck is sleep apnea?
Sleep
Well, yeah, so you stop breathing when you're sleeping, and it's kind of insidious because you wake up for such a short period of time that you don't really realize you're waking up, okay, in a lot of people. So this condition can persist for a long period of time, but you don't get any kind of restful sleep when that happens. And as a matter of fact, somebody that has sleep apnea, they might wake up maybe twice or even three times every minute, right, and then fall back asleep, and then kind of almost wake up to consciousness and then fall back asleep, okay. And then during that time, during that minute, they stop breathing. So what happens to ventilation when you stop breathing? What happens to oxygen inside alveoli? It starts to plummet. Well, your heart is still pumping blood. Your blood is still going through the lungs, absorbing oxygen, but there's not a lot of oxygen there. So oxygen concentration plummets. Oxygen concentration in your body starts to go down, and that triggers receptors that we're going to talk about in just a little bit that you're not breathing, so that's going to stimulate that wake-up response, and you're going to start gasping for air, and you're going to have a big sympathetic drive when that happens, all right? But in the lungs, all right, what did we say about lungs if there's no oxygen? Like when you stop breathing, there's no oxygen there, what happens to all these precapillary sphincters in your lungs? They start to close up. Right, so, all right, what happens then to blood flow through the lungs when, okay, all your whole lung starts to, all these precapillary sphincters start to constrict? Well, blood can't get through your lungs, all right, so then what happens to, what side of the heart pumps blood through the lungs? The right side of the heart, okay. Now, when you get your blood pressure measured, where do you measure blood pressure from? Okay, yeah, like a brachial artery over here, but is it a pulmonary artery or a systemic artery? It's a systemic artery, so it's very easy to measure systemic pressure, okay? But it's really difficult to measure pulmonary pressure because what kind of vessel do you need to measure? Like a pulmonary artery. Where are the pulmonary arteries? Yeah, they're inside your thoracic cavity. So in order to measure that, you got to get inside your thoracic cavity to measure that pressure. So typically, no one ever has their pulmonary pressure measured, all right? But if you have sleep apnea, this resistance goes way up because oxygen goes down, and then the right side of the heart, because it has to match the left side of the heart, that has to become a lot stronger to get blood through that circuit because the resistance is skyrocketing. Because what determines resistance really in a blood vessel is the radius according to the fourth power rule. So small changes in this diameter right here causes major changes in resistance. The right side of the heart now has three or four times the kind of workload, and as a muscle starts to exercise more, what happens to it? It gets bigger and stronger, so the right side of the heart, which usually is pretty weak and dinky muscle, right, it's not even a centimeter thick in most people, gets hypertrophied. All right, and unfortunately, over years and years of that over-exercise, then it fails. All right, you get right-sided heart failure. So sleep apnea can cause the right side of the heart to fail, and why that's so terrible is because hardly anybody ever looks at the pulmonary circulation. You can't really measure blood pressure there. You can't really measure much about the heart, but you did an experiment in lab. What did you do in lab that kind of looked at the balance of the right ventricle and left ventricle? You looked at the mean electrical axis, right? And as somebody's right ventricle hypertrophies, the mean electrical axis shifts as well. So that's kind of a nifty way of looking at pulmonary hypertension, right? And right-sided heart failure just by looking at that shift in the electrical axis. So, if you know anybody with sleep apnea, it's kind of like blood pressure. You should really help them to get treatment for that because that's only just one of the things how it messes up your body. Okay, it can actually cause heart failure, but not on the left side, on the left side of the body because of what? Ventilation perfusion matching. Because the pulmonary circulation works different than the systemic circulation. Okay, now how does, under normal circumstances, respiration, how is it controlled? All right, it's controlled by the respiratory center, which is in the medulla and the pons right here. All right, so that's in the brainstem. And even though the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle, it can be controlled pretty much automatically. Usually think of cardiac and smooth muscle as being controlled by the autonomic nervous system unconsciously, but the diaphragm can be controlled unconsciously by these different nuclei in the brain stem. And I think that's really all I want you to know about these different nuclei, is that they control respiration, right? And they're in the brain stem, the pons, and the medulla. And they control unconscious breathing. But you know, you could have a stroke in this part of the brain, and it could destroy some of these centers right here, and that might wipe out the automatic rhythmicity center. And there are some people that when they breathe, just like the biceps, right, that is under, every time the biceps contracts in people, it's under what? Voluntary control. You're sending direct information to the biceps to control under most circumstances. So, for instance, when you're sleeping, all right, perfect time to do exercise, but do you?
No.
No, you can't exercise when you're sleeping because you have no conscious control over those muscles. The same thing for the diaphragm when people have a lesion in the respiratory center of the brain. So as soon as they fall asleep, the diaphragm just never contracts, and then they're always waking up all night long, all right, to take a breath, or they die in their sleep. We call that Odin's curse. Right, when there is a lesion in this part of the brain that prevents automatic breathing. Okay. More importantly, I want you to know something about the receptors. All right, so automatic breathing is influenced by activity of chemoreceptors that monitor carbon dioxide, oxygen, and pH. And so You know a lot about metabolism right now. If you're going to pick one of these receptors right here, which one do you think is like the most important? Well, yeah, you guys are actually getting pretty smart. I always thought it was oxygen, right? Because you need oxygen to make ATP. So that's my initial understanding, okay? Now, these receptors are in two locations. These are, right, we're going to look at some peripheral receptors right here. And the peripheral receptors are in the arch of the aorta as well as the carotid sinus. Don't know if you were exposed to where the carotid sinus was in anatomy, but it's right at the bifurcation of the common carotid and the internal and external carotid. Right, there's a little bulge right here that we call the carotid sinus, and it has carotid bodies, which are stretch receptors and also chemoreceptors for CO2. Okay, there are also central receptors, and when we say central, what does that mean? Like central nervous system, right? Brain and spinal cord, in this particular case, is going to be in the respiratory centers. All right, so they're in the medulla. So these are the locations. So it's going to measure carbon dioxide, oxygen, and pH in the brain, but also in major arteries. And these arteries feed the brain, so it's going to protect the brain. Okay, so the chemoreceptors in the medulla and in the aorta and carotid sinus send information to the medulla, right, which is then going to affect automatic breathing, send signals to the spinal cord, to respiratory muscles. Like, for instance, what's the most important inspiratory muscle? The diaphragm, and probably from anatomy you should know the name of this nerve right here. That is the? Okay, some people are saying vagus, you're close, but not quite. It is the phrenic nerve, right? It's the phrenic nerve that goes all the way down to the diaphragm. All right, now what are the origins of that phrenic nerve, just for fun? Where does the phrenic nerve come from? Is it like from your thorax or where? It actually comes from C3, 4, and 5. Right, and then it goes through the cervical nerve plexus, and then the phrenic nerve is really, really long. So to help remember that, there's a little saying that says C3, 4, and 5. Does anybody know that? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. All right, so you don't want to have spinal cord damage ever, but if it is above C3, then you lose the phrenic nerve and you can't breathe, and then what do you need? Well, you need somebody that knows CPR that can breathe for you until you get to the hospital, right? Okay, and then you need to be on a ventilator. And we don't know how to repair spinal cords yet to get it to come back. All right, so chemoreceptors modify ventilation to maintain homeostasis, meaning normal levels of CO2, oxygen, and pH. And the most important compound is CO2. All right, so CO2 is the most important, and because of its effects on blood pH, according to this equation right here. All right, so CO2 and water can combine to form carbonic acid, which then dissociates into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. And so you should know the name of this enzyme that interconverts CO2 and bicarbonate right here. What is that? You already tested on that. That was the carbonic anhydrase, right? And enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, and there is no free energy change from one side of the equation to the other. So what does that mean in terms of establishing an equilibrium? If hydrogen ions increase inside your body, how does that affect this chemical reaction right here? Right? If hydrogen ions increase, that means you become more acidic. It's going to force the reaction to the left to make CO2 and water. All right? If CO2 builds up in your body, it's going to force this reaction to the right, and you're going to be producing this acid molecule and bicarbonate. That's just due to the carbonic anhydrase reaction. So hyperventilation produces low CO2. We call that hypocapnia. Capnia means low CO2. Hypoventilation, when, like during sleep apnea, that produces hypercapnia. And what can it do when you're hypercapnic? Hypercapnic, right, like during sleep apnea, okay, you wake up, but that does what? To your acid balance, all right? Yeah, it increases acid in your body. So your ventilation rate helps adjust your acid-base homeostasis, all right? So don't forget the name of this reaction right here. So hyperventilation, what can hyperventilation do? When you hyperventilate, you get rid of a lot of CO2 from your body, so bicarbonate is going to combine with hydrogen ion to replace that CO2. Oh, what's that principle? Yeah, that's the law of mass action, or another way of saying that is, what chemists like to call it, that is the Le Chatelier's principle, right? All right, so when you are hyperventilating, you are breathing basically acid right out of your body, and you become become basic, alkaline as a result. Okay. So I think next time we're going to start right here. This is the last kind of hard, difficult parts of this particular chapter. Okay, now who's got the sign-in sheet? Good. Don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. And watch for those other modules for the other chapters come up.